This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Know-How is brought to you by CashFly.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for TWiT's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make TWiT even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This episode of Know How is brought to you by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter promo code KNOWHOW to receive a free Tracker Bravo with any purchase. On today's show,
you'll know how to start your own streaming podcast studio.
Welcome to Know How. It's a TWiT show where we build, bend, break, and upgrade. I am Father Robert Ballasaire.
And I'm Brian Burnett.
And for the next however many minutes it takes, we're going to be showing you some of the stuff that we've been geeking out to so you can take it home and geek out on your own. Brian!
Padre.
Start of a new project.
Yeah.
We've been sort of teasing this for a while because we showed people some of the bits and pieces of gear that we enjoy using, from the cameras
the
to
microphones, lights.
Mixing board lights, precisely. We kind of want to tie that together. One of the things that I've been getting more and more often is people saying, okay, this is nice. I mean, I like a nice camera. Mm-hmm. I like a nice mic. I like a nice mixing board, but what if I actually want to start my own streaming podcast? What if I want to send out to Twitch or to YouTube Live? Mm-hmm. What's the easiest way to get there? So we're going to be focusing the next three episodes on how to build your own streaming studio for not that much money.
Right. Well, we do have some nice hardware sitting on the table, though.
Yes, we do. And, of course, we're going to be getting to this in just a bit. But this is some of the stuff that we've been playing around with. It's funny because, yes, all of the knowledge that we've dropped on people in previous episodes still works. Yeah, you still have to know how to light.
Right.
Yes, you still have to know how to choose your camera. Yes, you still know how to mix your audio. Yes, it's good to have an understanding of how you want to compose your shot. That's stuff that we've given to our audience before.
Yeah.
But now we want to specifically talk about what are some of the easiest ways for you to build a super high-quality podcasting studio without spending $1 million.
I was going to say, don't you just rent out a building and then you have like a brick wall on one side and about 43 cameras all hooked up to a grid on the ceiling.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
And then you're good to go.
You could do that. And you know what? This works for us because we do a lot of shows. But I mean, if you're just going to be doing yourself, just you know, showing you gaming or you doing a maker show or whatever it's going to be.
This is just a room in your house that you want to set up.
Just a room in your house. Now, you could go the super easy route. The super easy route is get a laptop with a camera and then stream out to YouTube. But we know our audience wants a bit more. You want to be able to switch, right? You want to be able to go from camera to camera. Maybe you want to put camera by camera. Maybe you want to be able to take inputs from your laptop.
Yeah.
If you do it the way that we do it here, I mean, the minimum cost is going to be about, what, $100,000? Because you're talking about $50,000 for our TriCaster, plus all of our cameras, plus our switcher, plus the Matrix. But I mean, it piles up
to that.
What if I told you that you could do all of this and have a super, super high performance, up to 4K broadcast studio for something like $3,000?
I'd say I believe it, but I'd like you to show me how.
And that's exactly what we're going to do. But first, we're going to do something that's a little bit uncommon since we changed the format of Know How. We used to be able to take sort of current event stories.
We
stopped doing that because, you know, it's not really our demographic. But there was
this
a story.
One you were geeking out on.
I was really geeking out to because this is something that I talked to Steve Gibson the last time I was hosting Security Now with him. Yeah. And, you know, it was sort of like, well, I'm sure there's a way to do it. I haven't really figured it out yet. Well, some people did. This has to do with the crack that was revealed yesterday in the ASLR. Addressing Space Layout Randomization. Okay, so ASLR is one of these things that we've sort of grown accustomed to having. You younger kids out there, you won't remember this, but there used to be a time when memory was written contiguously.
What?
I know, kind of crazy, right? So I think in order for us to understand this crack, and we will be getting to the streaming in a bit, but I really want to geek out to this with Brian for
please,
just a bit.
Please,
please
geek
please.
Out.
to understand this, let's jump back to the 90s. In the 90s, I was using Windows XP. We hadn't ever heard of ASLR. And the whole idea was when the operating system loaded, it loaded into the first bit of memory that you had. And then programs would load up contiguously, right? They would just, it would just keep filling until you filled up all your memory.
Right.
That's normal. That's kind of how you would write things down. The problem with doing that is it makes it incredibly easy to own your operating system.
How so?
Well, all I'd have to do is use a buffer overflow. We've talked about buffer overflows. Buffer overflows are, for example, if I'm allocated 64 bytes of memory and I write 128 bytes of memory, and there's nothing that stops me from doing that. There's no check to keep me from doing that. What will happen is I will fill up my 64 bytes, and then I'll take another 64 bytes. Mm. And that other 64 bytes, since the memory was written sequentially, it will overwrite what was in the next set of memory cells.
Okay.
Well, the problem with that is if I know that Windows is loading up in this part of the memory and I get allocated a memory cell that's right here and I overwrite by 64 bytes, I can now write into space that was protected, space that was supposed to be taken up by a crucial component or maybe even the Holy Grail, the part of memory that's being used for code execution. That's when I get what's called arbitrary code execution. I, as an attacker, can put instructions in that space. I can overflow and put instructions in that space to make the operating system do something that it doesn't want to do.
Okay. So it's not, it wouldn't just like crash the system. It's that you can actually take over and make
the first couple changes. Of times it will crash the system. Absolutely. Yeah. Because, I mean, when I was first playing around with this, you would write into that protected memory and you would basically turn it into garbage instructions and the computer would just go, I give up. But once you start figuring out what's happening and you can start targeting where you're writing in the memory space, if you can find that place where it executes code, you can put an entire instruction or entire set of instructions, and you can just do it again and again and again. And basically, I now am the super user. I can tell the operating system to do more than the operating system can do.
Wow. And so this new attack, though, it targets something else.
It targets the ASLR function. Okay, so let's look at my very wonderfully drawn representation.
Wow.
Forget this for a bit. This
is that a Triscuit on there?
This is what your memory looks like. So these are the sequential cells of your memory, right? So it would be writing here, 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 here. It would just keep going down the line as the memory fills up. In the old way of doing it, back in the 90s, because it was writing sequentially, if I chose this spot, and I overflowed. I did a buffer overflow. So I wrote more than I'm supposed to be allowed to. I could say take the four cells that I'm supposed to be taking plus the next four cells. If that's where code is executed, I can now make the computer do something I want it to do.
Ooh, right?
Right. So they developed a technique back in, I think it was first announced in 2001. It was part of a Linux project. They were looking for a way to stop this, to stop simple buffer overflows from being able to remotely execute code.
Okay.
They came up with the Linux PAX project. And the Linux PAX project came up with address space layout randomization. Very simple idea. The execution's kind of tricky, but simple idea. Instead of writing to contiguous memory cells, so next to each other, what if every time the computer starts, I randomize where stuff goes?
Yeah, it'd make it almost impossible, right?
Well, I mean, not impossible, very, very,
very difficult, yeah.
Right? Because now I can't just assume that my buffer overflow is going to go into the memory space because I don't know where the code is being executed.
Right.
It's not foolproof, as we know, because computers are still getting owned 20 years later. But what happens is, remember how you said what happens if a computer crashes?
Yeah.
That happens more than it gets owned.
Okay.
Because if I overflow, I could be overflowing the code execution area, or I could be overflowing someone's Word document.
I
could be overflowing the operating system and making the entire thing crash.
And I'm guessing every time you turn off the computer and turn it back on, it randomizes again?
It's going to re-randomize. And so there, you could still own computers, but the percentage of success of every attack went way, way down.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we were pretty good with that. I mean, if you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, it's no longer what it used to be. It used to be if you took a Windows XP box and you put it on the open internet, because we did this. We tested this at Interop. Every box was owned within 5 minutes. Every box.
Because it's just scrubbing, right? There's like programs just scrubbing for that.
You have people who are just scanning the address range of Interop at all times looking for open ports. And when they found XP, there was a plethora of open ports. They launched their favorite buffer overflow attack, and next thing you know, the operating system now belongs to them.
Wow. Okay.
That doesn't really happen anymore. I mean, you could still happen, but more often the computer will crash because of ASLR. Well, that's done now. Thanks to some wonderful researchers, and I do mean this. This was serious research, and yeah. I have nothing but respect for this. A group called, is it VUSEC? V-U-SEC. It's a Dutch group of security researchers. They figured out a way to defeat ASLR by exploiting the memory management unit. Okay, so think of this. With my my memory being written like this,
right,
the processor still needs to understand, still needs to know where everything is.
Right.
It can't guess. It has to know exactly where it's executing code. It needs to know where data is being stored. So there's a map. There's a page map that allows the CPU to say, oh, if I need this data, it's here. If I need that data, it's here. Right? Yeah. It's a table of contents.
Yeah, okay.
Right? Well, what modern CPUs will do is, because that map always has to be accessed, rather than storing it in main memory, I mean, it is in main memory, but they keep a copy in the CPU cache. The CPU cache, if anyone here who has played with hardware knows what this is, it's the memory that's on board. Mm-hmm. So, like, I buy an i7, and it's 3.9 gigahertz and 2 megabytes, or 3 megabytes, right? That's the cache. That's the memory that's built into the processor die, ridiculously fast.
Right.
Incredibly fast. It's more expensive to make, but because it's actually on the same die as a processor, it doesn't have to go through the bus like it does through memory. So it's exponentially faster to draw instructions from the CPU cache than from main memory. So what they've done for performance is they take that map and they put it in the CPU cache.
Okay.
Totally makes sense,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, definitely makes sense.
I mean, what
seems
do you want?
Logical.
Precisely. What do you want in the CPU cache? In the CPU cache, you want the instructions that are going to be called most often.
Right.
And you always need
quicker.
The map.
Yeah.
Because you can't do anything without the map.
Mm-hmm.
Problem.
I'm guessing like the map's not like an encrypted kind of thing.
Oh, it can't be encrypted. The CPU has to be able to see it. But I mean, here's where I think the genius of this crack comes into play. And this is why I think these guys are awesome. I want to meet them, shake their hands one day.
Yeah,
they figured out that they could utilize that to figure exactly where in the memory their program was located. And this is how they do it. If somewhere here. Let's do this. Somewhere here in the CPU cache, there is the page map, right?
Right.
The table of contents for my memory. Well, the CPU needs to be able to access that. What I can do is I can overwrite. I can't read the CPU cache. My programs can't, by design, I can't read it, but I can write to it. I can write to each cell, just individually. Write to the cell, wait. Write to the cell, wait. Write to the cell, wait. And what it's waiting for is how fast does the CPU respond.
Okay.
Because CPUs are very quick, so they'll respond almost instantly. If I overwrite a cell that contains a part of the page map, the CPU struggles a little bit, because what it has to do is, you just overwrote the map, it now has to go back out to main memory
and get
another copy of it.
Oh, wow. Okay,
so now I know it's slowed down, there's a piece of the page map in there.
And you're probably talking like slow down the fractions of a...
Yeah, like nanoseconds.
Yeah.
It's next to nothing, but,
but
it's measurable. It's detectable, because CPUs are very, they're very consistent.
Yeah.
I mean, you'll get the same response unless suddenly it has to do some extra instructions. And those extra instructions are to go back out to main memory and get another copy of the map.
Right. Okay. So now that you've located where that is on the CPU memory, what can you do?
Here's the thing. So I keep going, and I find all... I have to actually do this attack four times. I have to find the four different pieces of the map that I'm going to have in there, the boundaries of the map.
Mm-hmm.
And that will give me the offset. And the offset is what determines the randomization in the memory.
Oh,
and so now that I have the offset, I can find out exactly where in memory my program is located. If I know where my program is written, I can now figure out where code is being executed. I can now put random instructions into that area of memory, and I own the system.
So it's not random anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. It's owned. You're
owned. Yeah. That's
and
crazy.
The thing, and this is what makes this so beautiful. It sounds complicated, but it is a super, super simple attack. Basically, it's I do something and I listen.
Yeah.
And I do this enough times and I get enough data to know where in memory I should be writing my attack. It's actually brilliant.
Yeah.
Now, this is how bad it is. They haven't actually released the code because they're like, this is too dangerous. It's called a deep bug.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the hardware. It's not a software patch. This is the hardware that they're attacking.
Right.
You can't patch that.
No. And they had a list, right, of all the CPUs affected? Every CPU, it seemed like, in the last few years.
Every CPU is going to be using cache. I mean, yeah. It's everything from Intel, it's AMD, it's Samsung, it's Qualcomm. So, I mean, mobile processors, desktop processors, server processors. Yeah. If you use cache, and I can write to your cache, I can run this attack.
That's a little frightening.
it's frightening, but, you know...
But it's really cool at the
same time. There are a couple of ways to harden your system. Yeah. The way that Apple is choosing to do... Actually, they haven't announced it, but I'm pretty sure I figured it out. Yeah. All they're doing for their Safari browser... Because this attack can be run in JavaScript, by the way.
Because it has access to the hardware.
But which means I can be attacked going to a website. That's ridiculous. I think what they're doing is they're actually inserting artificial delays.
Oh, right.
They're basically fooling the malware into thinking that's where the page map is. It's not.
Right.
But that's not a fix.
No, that's
and nice. That actually slows me down. the fix would be don't put anything in the CPU cache, but then I take a huge performance hit. That's no bueno.
Oh man. So how can you get around this?
They have to fix it on the next generation of hardware. It's not as simple as they made a mistake. This is someone who's taking advantage of the fact that the processor has to process.
Right.
And the processor always needs to process, so I don't know how you fix that.
They're taking advantage of the fundamentals of how computers work.
Yeah.
Don't
freak out. I mean, yes, yeah. To some people, this is going to be scary. I find it absolutely fascinating. Read up on this. This is a great chance for you to find out exactly what ASLR does, which is it's wonderful. And then it's another chance for you to figure out how these security researchers actually figured this out. I wouldn't even think to start measuring response time of the processor because to most of us, response time is immediate.
Right. It is. Yeah. Oh, that is really cool. And as far as learning about the CPU cache and stuff, I always knew more was better, but I didn't actually know why. Cool.
And we'll follow the story. We don't normally do this on Know How, but this story was so incredible.
Yeah.
And so just really kind of genius that we had to geek out.
That's pretty smart.
Yeah.
Cool.
Now, let's get away from the security geeking, and we're going to be getting into the camera geeking. Ooh. We've got two cameras from Blackmagic that I've had my eyes on for 2 years. We saw these first at NAB 2 years ago, and they just, I want them. I want them now.
They're so tiny.
They are so tiny. Look at these. That's right. We've got a little 4K and a 1080p camera. These are the Blackmagic. These are the micros. We're going to get to that in just a bit, but first, let's take a moment for these messages. Now, we all know that we've got gadgets. We love our gadgets. We love our laptops. We love our phones. We love our bags. We love the little things that make our digital lives possible. What we don't like is losing them. And unfortunately, that becomes the sad, sad fact all too often. It's too easy to lose my phone. It's all too easy to leave my bag behind when I use the restroom at a coffee shop. It's all too easy for me to leave something on a park bench or on top of my car or in a random location. Wouldn't it be nice if I had a bit of tech that allowed me to track all of my most valuable technologies? Well, we do. And it's called the Tracker. The Tracker is a coin-sized device that allows me to tag everything that I need not to lose. Now, the average American wastes 55 minutes a day looking for the things that they own, but they can't find. The Tracker makes losing things a thing of the past. And oh, by the way, stay tuned because I can tell you how to get one of these for free. The Tracker Bravo locates misplaced keys, wallets, luggage, instruments, bicycles, electronic devices, even pets in seconds. That little coin-sized device is constructed with an anodized aluminum case for the thinnest, most durable tracking device possible. You can attach it to your items via a key loop or adhesive. It's enabled by Bluetooth LE, so the battery lasts for up to a year. And you can add your own laser-engraved message to each Tracker Bravo, like return or pet info. And now you can personalize your tracker with a custom-printed image. You can pair your tracker, really simply, to your iOS or your Android device and find its precise location with a tap of a button. You can pair up to 10 devices at once, which means that you can track your phone, your bag, your pets, your whatever your that guy just pulled out of his pocket, all together. Now, here's the cool thing. It also does reverse tracking. There's a little button on the back of the tracker that if I push will cause my phone, my smart device, to ring even if it's set to silent. Think about how many times you go around trying to figure out where you left your phone. Well, now you could just press a button and it'll call you to it. With over 3.5 million devices shipped, Tracker also has the largest crowd GPS network in the world. And this solves the problem of what happens when you go out of range. I mean, if you've got a tracking device, but you're not close enough to your smartphone or your tablet or wherever you've got the app installed, what good is it going to do for you? Well, with Tracker, it still works. Because with their crowd GPS, as long as your device is within range of any Tracker user, you can still get a notification on your phone. As long as they come within 100 feet, you'll always know where your coolest tech is found. Folks, stop losing your stuff. Just go to thetracker.com and never lose your possessions again. Plus, just for our audience, if you enter promo code KNOWHOW, you'll get a free Tracker Bravo with your order. That's thetracker, thetracker.com, promo code KNOWHOW to get your free Tracker Bravo today. Tracker, never lose your stuff again. And we thank Tracker for the support of KNOWHOW. Okay, Brian, so at CES, I saw some of the Blackmagic Designs gear.
Yeah.
And it got me thinking I needed to upgrade my plan. We're going to get to my beautiful little micros
here. Your
little
friends
in a bit.
There, yeah.
But first, I wanted to show you where my techno lust started.
Okay.
A while ago, we got to take a look at their Ursa, which was sort of this, the first time I saw a super high-capable 4K device for under $10,000. And I don't mean like, oh, my camera phone does 4K. I mean an actual camera that could be used in video production, in broadcast quality, in cinema quality. It was called the Ursa, and, well, this is what it looks like. I'm at the Blackmagic Designs booth, and I'm standing next to Kendall Ekman, who's going to explain what they've done with the Ursa Mini. Kendall, what is this?
Well, as you remember from last year, we had the Blackmagic Ursa camera that we launched out. Beautiful camera, 10-inch screen on the side. You had your monitors here with scopes, and it really was set up as a workflow camera where you could do audio guy on one side and maybe a guy pulling focus on the other. Great camera. A lot of people wanted to see us do something a little more portable, a little more handheld, and they asked us to build something a little bit smaller, and that's what we've come out with this year is the Ursa Mini. So as you can see, it's a little bit more compact. It's 5 pounds, so it's nice and light. You can get it on your shoulder. You can pull it around down here low, get some angled shots, things like that. We have a 5-inch screen. It's all touchscreen here, 1920 by 1080, so you can view there if you want to. We actually have CFast cards here to record to, so you can, once one fills up, it'll automatically switch over to the next one. If I pan it around here, and these are a lot of the same features you see on the original Ursa camera. We have the battery pack here on the back, Super 35 size sensor. This camera actually comes in a PL or EF mount. And you can see here we have rosettes built in. The reason for that is the camera itself ships with the handle here. You screw it in with the rosettes, and you can add on an optional shoulder mount here. For $395, we have a shoulder mount, an extension arm, and a top handle. The rosettes can be put into numerous places there with the handle, depending on how you want to hold the camera. You have your traditional things, SDI out, reference in, time code in. Now, the nice thing about this camera is it comes with power and a 12-volt out to go to our new electronic viewfinder. So if we spin it around here, you can see this is actually a viewfinder that can work on the Ursa Mini, or it can also work on the original Ursa camera. It's beautiful. It has optical glass in there, 1920 by 1080, full HD. You can pull up focus charge. You can pull up the focus peaking inside there, too. And it has an OLED actual sensor in here so that you can go and make sure that it doesn't burn out the OLED by being eye sensitive, or you can turn it on flashing under here. And it 15 stops of dynamic range in the 4.6 model, so it's amazing. Gets up to 60 frames a second, too.
Now, that Blackmagic Ursa, it comes in a couple of different configurations. Actually, Alex, we have a link here. The lowest price is just under $3,000. It's the one, the 4K with the EF mount. You know, you get to choose what kind of mount, what kind of sensor. They've also got the one that's 4.6K, so it's got a slightly bit more resolution. It's $5,000. Yeah, it's a little pricey, but, I mean, a camera with those features, with interchangeable lenses, I mean, yeah, that's seriously, because at that same show, I was also looking at some of the Red cameras. Mm-hmm. And the Red camera that matched the low spec Ursa was $15,000. So what? It's like, well, I mean, which one am I going to choose?
Yeah, no, I've always lusted after Blackmagic stuff. I just the price point is never in my range, but for what they're capable of doing on those cameras is pretty impressive.
Exactly. And that's what we're going to be getting to right after these messages.
Previously on Twit.
Okay, Google, play medieval music.
Here's a Google Play music station called Folk Metal.
Folk Metal? Okay, Jarvis, stop!
iOS Today.
National Nightmare is over, ladies and gentlemen. Finally, Jason will get his Pixel back and you'll get your iPhone back.
What I realize at the end of the month is, I mean, it's just another OS that does the same darn thing.
They get amazing battery life out of this.
Out of sheer laziness, have gotten into the habit of not plugging it in at night because I knew it would make it to the next day.
All about Android.
Was there anything that just like did not work on Android that really frustrated you that you just really missed from iOS?
Well, I missed iMessage, really. But there's nothing else that everybody uses.
Tech news today.
The Wall Street Journal reports on a new handheld device that will tell you if you smell bad. A gadget called Kun Kun. It connects with a smartphone app, which will tell you whether or not you stink.
If you think that you need a dedicated device to tell you whether you smell, you smell.
Yeah.
That's my guess.
Right.
Twit, making the world safe for technology.
Megan, have you ever had an Android phone? You
did. Oh, yeah. Right? But I've always been a Mac user. I was just forced into using Android. And I don't hate it.
That's the praise we're looking for.
Okay. So it's time. You were saying how you you like Blackmagic stuff, but it was always a little out of your price point.
Definitely.
Let's look at something that's a bit more within your price point.
Cool.
You may remember, I'm a big fan of the Panasonic cameras, the HD-HMC 150s, just because they're high quality. You know, they were about $3,000. They were not too expensive. Mm-hmm. They were all in one, sort of a camera studio on your shoulder.
Yeah, no, I like using that camera when we're out in the field and stuff.
Super nice camera, super simple to use, but one of the things that's always sort of been lacking for me is the interchangeable lenses. I would love to be able to swap out the lens when I need a super wide shot, go to a zoom lens, a telephoto when I need something a little closer. There are adapters I can screw onto the end of the barrel for that camera, but that's not the same.
No, definitely not.
And that's really what has me so hot and bothered about these are the Blackmagic Micros. I've got the Micro Cinema and the Micro Studio. So this is a 1080p camera right here. This is a 4K camera. Let's start with the 1080p because this thing is pretty spectacular. So this is the package. I mean, it's basically what they tried to do with the design philosophy is they wanted an action camera format, but with the quality and flexibility of a cinema-style camera. This is for those people who want a quality camera, but they don't want to risk that $15,000 rig.
Right.
They've done so many things right. First of all, this is an active micro four-thirds lens mount. That means that you can use all of those lenses that are coming out with the new DSLRs. This also has active control, so I can use focus iris control with the proper lens.
Very cool.
You know, so if I want to control everything centrally, I can do that. Inside, I've got a super 16-millimeter sensor, which is just, it's fantastically like sensitive. I get a nice big picture. Now, this is something that's like Leo quality. Leo likes these kinds of sensors, these kinds of sizes. Huh. It's going to have, you've got a internal stereo omnidirectional microphone along with a 3.5 millimeter audio in. So if I need to hook up an external microphone, I can use that here. Nice. I've got buttons for record, play, rewind, menu, and power. So I can control everything here. Now you will notice there's no screen. So unlike, say, one of the new GoPros that has a screen on the back, this doesn't. This really is designed to be a camera unit that's connected to something else or, and I'll show you in a bit, set up on a quadcopter.
Yeah.
Now, as for my ports, I've got a standard SD card slot. This will support both SDHC and SDXC memory cards. I've got HDMI out. This thing will use Canon batteries, which are very common. In fact, I will show you in the next episode how these same batteries are shared on the Blackmagic screens.
That's awesome. Because they could have just done the proprietary thing.
Precisely. They could have said, hey, it's a Blackmagic battery. It costs $300. Like, no, look. A lot of people already have Canon. Why not just take a Canon battery and pop it in? Also means it'll work with the expanded capacity Canon batteries if I want a lot of time on this.
Okay.
It's also got, and this is the part that really sort of sold it for me. It's got this expansion port. It looks like a little serial port or mm-hmm. VGA port on the end here. What I can do is I can connect it to this, or I can make my own harness. And with this harness, I get a lot. So what I have really quickly, of course, there's power. There's also LANC. That's the logic application control bus for Sony. So if I want to sync this, so if I'm like syncing multiple cameras, this has the ability to do that.
That's cool.
It's got Genlock. It's got four analog PWM and 18-channel S-bus. People who haven't watched our quadcopter episodes are saying, what's that?
Yeah.
Well, it means this is ready to be hooked up to your receiver so you can control the functions of the camera from your transmitter if you're going to be using this on a quadcopter.
You don't even have to be using it on a quadcopter.
You can use PWM. So we've played with PWM so many times on this show, but I can use that to control everything from the iris to the zoom. Or to say the gimbal that it's attached to. So I can use pan, tilt, and zoom all through my transmitter. I mean, already that's ridiculous. That's absolutely fantastic. So that's the hardware.
Right.
Let's talk about the specs. So with this awesome sensor, I'm going to get 13 steps of dynamic range. That Ursa did 15. Mm-hmm. This is 13. That's pretty dang good. And remember...
Yeah, and that's form factor?
That's the form factor. So 13 stops. Remember, a stop, anytime I talk about a stop, it means I'm either doubling or halving. A stop up, I'm doubling. Right. A stop down, I'm halving the amount of light. Which means, think about that, the amount of light this can deal with from the very least to the most, mm-hmm. 13 stops. So 13 doubles.
Yeah.
That's amazing. A GoPro does... like six.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you want really dynamic range, if you want all those colors, that's what you're going to get with this.
Cool.
Also, it records in Cinema DNG RAW or Apple ProRes 422 at 220 megabits per second. It'll do 1080p, 23.98, 24, 25, 29, 97, 30, 50, and 59, 94, and 60.
Wow.
So, I mean, I've got basically all the resolutions I'm going to want. And let's use it a little bit. What lens do I want to put it on?
I like that it also has a little mount on the top if you want to attach like a camera. Or not a camera, but like a light or something. Yeah.
And then on the bottom, which mm-hmm. is pretty standard. So let's do this. I borrowed these lenses from Leo, so let's not break them. they're not the best glass. I could get much better glass, like the $10,000 lens he has, but I felt not comfortable.
I don't know if he trusts you with that.
Borrowing that. I'll turn it on. You know what helps when you want to turn it on?
Battery?
Yeah, they like those. There we go. Okay, let's go and hook this thing up. So this is, it's fantastic. It's spectacular. I really love the way that it looks. I'm going to show you some of the menu system here. I think I'm outputting 1080p 30 frames a second at the moment on this, but... this is what we...
And the way you know that it's on is there's a little light on the top.
Yeah, a little light on the top.
I guess it turns red when you're recording.
Precisely. I mean, I don't have a memory card in here right now, so it's not going to record, but there we go. So...
oh, hey. Whoa.
Okay, I'm a little washed out right now. I don't have the settings right. And I also... this is not a lens that supports autofocus. So, hold on.
It's so dramatic looking.
So dramatic. Wait, so doge. And actually, let's go ahead and jump into the menu. Let's not make people dizzy here for a second. Oh, jeez. I'm getting
steady
dizzy.
Yourself.
I know what. Unfortunately, it's a 75 millimeter, so it's not, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Go into the menu system here. So I can choose my codec. In this particular case, I'm doing RAW. I'm probably not going to shoot in RAW all that often just because that uses up a ridiculous amount of space.
Padre, shoot RAW or don't shoot at all is what I say.
Dynamic range, I can set my dynamic range for, let's say, I got a film right now. Let's, wait, come here. It's hard looking up and down here. So frame rates, iris control. Right now I've got set for ISO of 1400, of 400. Mm-hmm. I can go all the way up to 1600 if I really want to bring it in. But just like a real camera, if you do that, you're going to start bringing in the grain here.
Yeah.
The menu system is not the friendliest, but it does do everything you need it to do. So I can play with color temp here, all the way from 28 up to 65K, depending on what you need to set it for in the studio. As a unit, mm-hmm. this is probably one of the most capable cameras I've ever played with. And here's the thing: if you go to the link for this, Alex, it's $1,000.
Wow.
And this is something that just a year ago, 2 years ago, I would have expected to pay $3,000 for.
That is insane.
At the least. And it just, it works really well. It looks really well. And I have used it on a quadcopter. In fact, Alex, we've got, there's a webpage I put in there, some of the demos. You can go ahead and run through some of those just to show them what it looks like. The film quality, it just, look at that. I mean, when if you know what you're doing, if you combine this with the right lens, if you shoot properly, it looks really, really, really good.
Huh. Yeah, I mean, this looks like movie quality.
It is movie quality. I mean, and it's for people who, if you've used a DSLR, if you're used to using a DSLR, this will feel right at home, just a lot smaller.
That is cool.
Yeah. So this is the Cinema Micro, or the Micro Cinema. This is the one that they've really designed to be sort of the action camera out and about. This is the one that you would take to, say, CES. You would put this on a wooden camera frame along with a large screen on the back. And, I mean, this is far more capable than the Panasonic I was using. Yeah. I will say one thing, though, and you know this, and Leo really, really knows this.
What's that?
When you use cameras like this, you will soon start hating every lens you have because every lens you have is never as good as you need it to be. And
right.
So you always spend more and more on a good piece of glass.
Well, you know, if I've learned anything from Leo or what he's told me is that if you buy good glass, it's an investment.
It really is.
You know, like... It stays the same price.
It spoils you, though, because I played around with Leo's lens, and now the lenses I have at home, I'm like, stupid lens.
It's the lens's fault.
It's my shots don't pop because of the lens. I should get a
$10,000 slippery slope. It's amazing how much the bodies have come down in price, but the lenses will always stay the same.
Well, the thing is, quality glass is quality glass, and I mean, they craft them the same. So the technology for these sorts of sensors and the electronics around the sensors will come down, but that glass still needs to be ground. Yeah. That's not going to come down much.
Pretty cool.
All right, so that is our 1080p sort of action cam.
Right.
The reason why I would suggest something like this for a studio is because you can get all of the functionality of a DSLR or of a handheld camera, but at a lower price point with higher quality, with more expandability. I mean, this is, if you can stand the learning curve, and there is a learning curve to using a higher end piece of equipment, and it's not a point and shoot. This is not turn it on and forget it. Mm-hmm. This is a very, very good choice.
Yeah, I think the only real downside is that you don't have any way of interfacing with it unless you have like an extra screen. Yeah.
And believe it or not, we're going to cover that in the next episode. What? Go figure. All right, let's take a look at the 4K because there's not a lot of streaming going on in 4K, and actually I wouldn't stream in 4K because most people don't have the ability to receive a 4K stream in any sort of way that does it justice. I mean, even over YouTube Live, which you can stream in 4K, a lot of times you get artifacts and compressing just because the pipes just aren't ready for that, right?
Right.
But some people still like the ability to be able to stream in 4K. So what if you could take that, have a 4K sensor, and then broadcast in 1080p now and switch to 4K when people are ready for it?
In the future,
And that's what we get with this. Ooh. This is the Blackmagic Studio, Blackmagic Design Micro Studio Camera 4K. Mm-hmm. Alex said we have a link for this. A little bit more expensive. So $1,300, and most of the customer reviews are all... I didn't like it because it was too hard to use.
There's only three, so not a really wide net there.
Not a super wide net. It is, again, there's a learning curve to this, but this is a fantastic device. In fact, I one of the reasons why I asked Blackmagic to loan us these units is I wanted to figure out which one I wanted, and I'm pretty sure I'm going with this.
You think so?
Yeah, because I have recording devices. I have an SDI recording device already, a Panasonic.
Right.
This will work with that. I tested that, and so I'm like, well... If I don't need the onboard recording, why not get the 4K?
Yeah, and sometimes I like to shoot things in 4K, and then if I'm going to take stills or something like that, or a time lapse, shoot it in 4K and then crop it. You know, it's much easier to crop later on.
Yeah. All right, let's talk a little bit about the design philosophy. So here's our camera. This is really for those people who want 4K quality in places where, say, a larger format 4K camera won't fit. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can put this in a corner where a RED camera would never fit. I could mount this outside of a car if I wanted to get that car chase scene.
Yeah.
And I'm risking a $1,300 body and maybe a $300 lens versus a $15,000 camera.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, again, if you use a DSLR, this is pretty much going to be the same workflow as a DSLR. So if you don't want to change up your workflow, this is a really good use. But ultimately, the differentiation they make between the cinema and the studio is this was really designed for studio use. It does not have an onboard recorder. There is no SD card slot. All this will do is we'll take the image and we'll push it out either through HDMI or through the SDI outputs.
Okay.
So let's talk a little bit about the hardware. Inside of the cinema, I've got a 16 millimeter sensor, right?
Mm-hmm.
Here, I've got a 13.056 millimeter by 7.322 millimeter. That is a huge 4K sensor. That is a wonderful piece of silicon right there. again, I've got an active Micro Four Thirds mount, supports focus and iris controls on all the supported lens. I've got SDI input and output, and both of them will do 1.5G, the standard 270 megabits per second,
mm-hmm.
1.5G, 3G, and 6G, so I can get super high bit rates on this thing, as well as an HDMI output. But the HDMI output will only do 1080p. Here's the cool thing, though. It will output to both at the same time. If I wanted to put a monitor, so I can always see it, like mm-hmm. put like we have here at the studio, I could put a monitor right here,
and then
this side
goes
to the switch.
Yeah.
And that's a cool feature. I mean, for me, that would do it. I mean, that's what makes it so useful in the studio. Also has an integrated mic, plus a mic in if I want to put audio through here. It also has a talk back. So, and if you want to set up a studio where, like, your director can talk back to you, you can hook your headphones up to this, and they can talk to you through the control channel.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
How cool is that?
Yeah.
It's also got the expansion port, slightly different layout than I have on the cinema. Mm-hmm. This has a power LANC, S-Bus, PTZ output. So you can mount this on a PTZ, and you can control this through the SDI control.
Oh, that would be great.
And actually, in the next episode, I'm going to remind people of a little device that does just that.
Nice.
Also has Genlock and a B4 lens control. So, you know, basically, this is one of these cameras where if I put this on a PTZ mount with the appropriate lens,
mm-hmm.
the director, because this can actually be controlled through the TriCaster, our director
could move it, focus, zoom in,
and out.
Wow.
And 4K. At this mm-hmm. quality.
Yeah.
So that's the hardware. Let's talk about the specs. Of course, it's a 4K camera, so this is going to do 4K. It's got 3840 by 2160 and 1920 by 1080. It'll do both of those resolutions. 4K, it will do 23.98 frames per second, then also 24, 25, 29.97, and 30. At 1080, it will do 23.98, 24, 25, 29, 97, 30, 50, 59, 94, 60, 50 interlaced, as well as 59.94 interlaced and 60 interlaced. So, again, all of my favorite flavors of of high def.
Yeah.
Okay, now, of course, it's going to be using the same Canon system, so same Canon batteries. And now let's take a look at how it's actually going to look. Which lens do you think we should use for this one, Brian?
Let's go with that silver one.
This is fixed 75 millimeter. That might be a bit too much. What's that?
This is 40 to 150 millimeter.
40 to 150. Okay, let's try that. This is probably going to make people really sick.
Zoom in.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, when you use this, you're probably going to want to have a tripod just...
Yeah, go just figure.
Huh? Silly like that. Can't let this come back up. And now, what I like about this particularly is the fact that I can output simultaneously to HDMI and SDI.
Yeah.
It gives me a really nice feel for this. So are we getting a feed from this yet?
Looks like it.
Zoom back out.
Woo.
Whoa.
Oh, who's that? Never seen that guy before.
Oh, I like this. This is Alex. Alex.
Enhance. Zoom.
Sorry. Okay. So, but if I take a look at the menu system here, it looks a lot like the. I don't want to mess with the resolution, but I can have gain controls, white balance, basically everything you would expect from a higher end camera. Hold on.
The same amount of stops.
No. So this is 11 stops versus 13.
Oh, okay.
So this has a slightly less dynamic range, but I find the color in this to be nicer. What's our color temperature again? Is it 47?
4800.
Yeah, 4800. Okay, good. So that's matched to our lights now, so that's giving us true white. I've just scratched the surface. One of the things about Blackmagic cameras, and you alluded to this, Brian, is, you're going to get a lot of features, but then you have to know how to use the features.
Right. The
features do you good if you can't actually run them.
Exactly. You got to know what you want.
Yeah. And speaking of what you want, that's what we need to talk about. Because between these two,
mm-hmm.
I've got, they are in a very nice place. This is the camera where I basically have a self-contained studio. Mm-hmm. This is the action cam. This records on SD on the camera. I do need a way to view the output, but it still works pretty much like every other camera I know. This, because it has no internal recording, I really would only use this inside of a studio unless I want to carry around a digital recorder with me. But it's going to work pretty much the same way that this works. But it gives me 4K, it gives me slightly better color reproduction, and it also gives me that dual output that I really, really like.
Yeah, see, for my situation, if I were going to get one of these cameras, I would like the action cam kind of aspect of it, so I'd be wanting to go out in the field, you know, really utilize the size of it, and so I would probably go with this one.
Really?
Just because...
Because it's got the internal recorder.
The internal recorder, yes, and as much as I would like to record 4K video, most of the stuff that I work on or work with now, like 1080 is more than enough for my needs.
See, I see that. And actually, I will admit that I'm probably going to get the 4K, but 99.999% of the time I will be recording in 1080p.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, here at Twit, we output 720.
You know, the 4K's exactly.
But, and, you know, the other thing about this is it does have two more stops. So it is a bit more light sensitive. But with the 4K, I think I prefer the way that it does the color. Mm. I think looks nicer on the 4K.
Well, that's why you just shoot raw, and then you can change all that post.
Well, see, and that's the other thing. I understand why professionals want to shoot raw or ProRes. It totally makes sense. I get it. But those files are way too big for me. All my stuff is AVC HD. So what I would end up doing, if I got this, I would end up hooking this up to my recorder and recording 1080p on AVC HD just because I want to be able to store everything. I don't want to have to chalk everything every time I'm done with a project. So the same thing I'm going to be doing with that is what I'm going to be doing with this. This is going to be hooked up to a 1080p recorder in AVC HD. It means that I am not using anywhere near the capacity of the resolution.
Right.
It means that I'm actually down converting to a format that's not going to do the image and the sensor and the glass any justice.
Right.
But it does mean that it's going to be more useful for me in the long run, which is why I'm going to go with this, because I'm going to hook this up to a little screen on the side, and that will be my preview screen, and this is going to go over to my switcher.
Nice. Yeah, that's a pretty sweet setup, then.
I don't know. Okay. Now, in the next episode, what we're going to do is we're going to show you what you actually do with these cameras. So if you decide to go one way or another, you need a way to broadcast it. Now, you could go, again, the Twit route and get yourself a nice switcher and an encoder and a TriCaster and pay a tidy sum of money. But remember, we want to keep this project under $3,000. Yeah. I've got a little box that not only will accept up to 4 inputs from your laptop, from your cameras, even from a browser built into the box, but has integrated into the box streaming to both Twitch and YouTube Live.
Ooh, yeah, that sounds awesome.
We're gonna be bringing that up in the next episode of Know How. Now, we know that this was a lot of information, especially with all the stuff about the cameras. Don't fret, because we've got links and information for you at our show notes page. And Brian, where did they find those?
twit.tv/KH. And like Padre said, you'll find links to these cameras, the prices, and the breakout of some of the specs and stuff like that. And while you're there, you can also subscribe, because this is going to be a multiple-parter episode. And you'll want to download so you can go back and rewatch.
Indeed. And also, don't forget that if you've got questions or if you have any suggestions for how we take this project in the future, your best bet is to jump into the social. Specifically, go over to Google+. Google+, look for the group Know How. There's a very short approval process to keep out all the spam accounts. But once you're in, you get access to almost 11,000 Kitas. That's our know-it-alls who can help you with projects, suggest new projects, or maybe need the knowledge that you have in your little noggin. Again, go to Google+ and look for Know How.
That's right. But if you want to find out what we're doing on an upcoming episode, or you want to see some of the videos that Padre is probably going to make with these cameras, you're going to want to follow us on Twitter. I'm @Cranky_Hippo.
And you're going to find me @PadreSJ. And you're going to find the third member of our group. Hold on, wait.
Enhance.
Wait, let me get rid of the menu here.
He's not going to go to that shot.
Menu. There. Menu. Yeah. Come on. Wait, there we go.
He's somewhere back there in the darkness.
Switch to it, Alex. Come on. And you can find our... This is Alex something. Alex Jones?
Alex Grumple.
Oh, God, no.
You can find him at ANELF3. That's twitter.com/ANELF3. Until next time, when we continue our romp into your under $3,000 streaming studio, I'm Father Robert Ballasaire.
I'm Brian Burnett.
And now that you know how,
go build it. Or go shoot some camera stuff. Yeah, I'll take this one if you take that one.